and stupid, really. The first way that I thought about dealing with a safe brute force is the same way that you can deal with spam on OpenBSD, right? The spamd target, where you build a block of IP addresses and then you do something with that block of IP addresses. The list is dynamically generated based on your whatever conditions, right? So here's a little excerpt from the pf.conf file. I don't know if you guys can really see that. Probably not.
Did everybody in the back read that at all?
Probably not. I was all these people.
Is that better? That was going to be a really long one.
Same thing in the honeypot?
It's not in honeypot. BF has this thing called tables, right? And the other thing that BF has that's really cool is basically connection tracking. So, this line over here, which is going to be a very long line, this line over here says that, huh?
You're coming in between those segments? That is ridiculous.
Not anything that you can see them. Is that better?
Sort of.
All right. Well, now I lost my place, right? Okay, here we go. All right, so BF allows you to keep track of the connection rates, like the actual initial SIM packet to initiate the connection, right? So what you're saying here is that if somebody's trying to send you a SIM to port 22 more than 8 times in 60 seconds, you dump them into a table called target. And then further down in your rule set, you say, that. Sorry, Julia, I know it's retarded. So basically what you end up doing is you have a firewall that's always running, and it sees that there is more than 8 times per minute that somebody's trying to connect to a port 22, and it's going to add them to that block list that can be permanent. It's a persistent table of these IP addresses. Now, I just block any further attempts from those IP addresses, but you obviously can do all kinds of nasty things. Like, you can actually pipe it back to that spamd daemon from OpenBSD, where it's going to, like, you know, try to pretend to be a mail server, and it's going to be a really, really slow conversation. So you're actually going to waste these people's CPU cycles. Does that make sense? Like, is that... All right. So, since it's really small... Like, it's really one of those things where you just copy-paste this into your pf.conf and it just works. I guess I can give you a link to this later, if you guys really want to. And the other thing that I did, this is more proactive, and that's because it pisses me off when people waste my CPU cycles. I wrote this little, it's really ugly, disgusting little Perl script, and what it does is on FreeBSD, every day the box will email you the logs of the day, right? So if you have, like, denied logon attempts, like over here I have, this is much worse. But this is my mailbox for root on this specific server, and FreeBSD does this daily security run output, where all of these things, the logs over here, those are failed attempts to brute force my passwords for all these IP addresses. So what I did is I wrote a little script and I stuck it. It's being called from procmail, which is this part here. So every day the script will go and it will keep doing whois on these IP addresses, like Aaron whois or write whois if it has to forward that far, and it will find the actual email address for the contact for that block, that IP block. And it will email those four people once for every attempt for this brute force. I don't actually use this anymore. This was kind of like a hack and something to, you know, to do to piss people off. But it's pretty effective because, you know, when you send somebody 1,000 emails saying that your server is compromised, then usually, you know, they get back to you. Maybe they're not very happy about it, but they do get back to you.
So solving the brute force attack in this case.
Right, I mean, there's no fighting back to you because, come on, I mean, it does get really, really annoying. Right.
So whatever you get back from.
No, nothing. It's just really to irritate the actual owners of the IP block, which is almost pointless. But if it's a small enough network, somebody owns that /24, and there's a contact for it, then chances are they'll be able to pinpoint the problem easier versus somebody who, like, bought a /8 and it's somewhere on their network.
It's not necessarily the real IP address.
Huh?
It's not necessarily the real IP address.
No, it's not. Well, it has to be, because you do have to create an actual TCP conversation. If you want to initiate the conversation to the SSH server, if you do the handshake, you know, that would have possible passwords. You do have to have a really different address. For no, for this part, this is just Perl. I mean, this is the first thing. That's the first thing for putting them in a table, the same way that SpamD does it. Right. So this is the other way. This is just to irritate the people who supposedly own those IP blocks. In this case, in my case, it's actually a block list because there is an explicit block quick whatever from that table. But you can set it to be a target, and I guess you could write your own fake SSH server to really waste their CPU cycles, which, you know, sure is not that hard. Or you can just spam the OpenBSD thing again, where what it does is it sends the actual send buffer on the socket to like 1 byte for every second or whatever. So the conversation is not being really, really slow. And these guys are waiting for SSH bound, they're not getting it, they're getting this fake mail server. You know, pisses their computers off.
Just
because then I have to write more Perl.
You know what?
I'm not gonna write any more Perl.
Is it my buffer or is it called that?
Yeah, there's not, right?
No.
It is Perl.
Well, yeah,
you never know. And the other, almost not really related to this, is that in SSH config itself, you can have designated allowed groups for people with SSH. So if you're running like a more general purpose server, then you can say that only these guys in this group can SSH at all. And even if it tries to brute force other accounts, even if it finds the password for that account, SSH will just not let it SSH in. So that's the third little tip. And the last thing is deny hosts, which I've never ever used. But there's this article over here, which actually goes, it discusses more different software types like deny hosts that will either sit there and scour your logs for these attempts and actively block them, or, you know, whatever this is. I like the PF method personally because you're cutting them off at, you know, TCP level, so, and it just stays in your file, and then you can keep that IP address list for whatever. You can mail the administrator, you can call the feds if you want to. You know, it's just there. And this is really it. Yeah.
May I add something to your PF?
Yep.
Thing?
Please.
Another thing that
can you speak louder?
Sure. Another thing that I was just going to add to the PF way of doing things. Another way that I combat this is that I block OSs on port 22 that I know won't be talking on 22. Basically, if you can stop Linux talking to it, you're basically okay.
Well, it's actually a funny story. I get my girlfriend an account on my home computer, right? So I set her password to the same thing as the username. The box naturally gets owned, it gets brute forced. But if you port scan the box that owned it, some like random machine in Japan, there's a shell bound to a port because you can bind like bash and TCP port, whatever. So I tell it to it, I get root prompt on that machine. So you can actually, if you really want to spend time on this, you can start owning these boxes back, because a lot of times people that come into your network, owning your network, they don't bother to secure, you know, their own assets, right? So I called the NOC in Japan, and the numbers listed didn't work, and that's like a whole other issue with the internet.
Yeah. I got two comments on this. My host thing, that's something I use, and it essentially does exactly what your script does, and then has the options to
email people,
file and purchase, you know, list automatically after whatever set amount of time, handling it, and allow gives you like little reports of emails, you know, all that. And as far as the machine that I actually scanned, I was setting up a machine at work, and she still put me out of the root password of Apollo. And within, I mean, minutes, the machine got out.
Well, you should never let it SSH into his room.
The reason he probably got it is that machine, and actually what those bots do, they patch your machine, and they essentially become yet another bot doing exactly,
right.
Experience, but exactly what it did.
They do, but a lot of times they will dump a root shell bound on port, whatever, like stupid 50,000 range port.
Yeah.
And if you just tell that to that port, you get an actual, you know, you get the hash symbol. You can do whatever that means. I mean, that owning boxes that way has been around since, like, whatever, 96, 97. But yeah, I just want to make clear that this whole, like, nasty parse SSH thing, that's totally separate from the PF way of doing this. PF way is actually just blocking these people from doing it further. Unfortunately, you guys can't see this, but, like, If you guys run FreeBSD machines and you look at your own security mails daily for denied logins, It's probably going to be longer than this. Like, this is like one, like 2.5 pages, right? And all these IP addresses will show up 8 times at most versus 1,000 times whatever, because these guys are in my BF block table, which is this whole thing. And they stay there forever, so.
Barbara,
can
you
grab
it?
Thank you.
Anyway, I don't know, like, I can give you guys a link to this little text file.
Can you post it to the talk list later?
Yeah, I'll
just
post it.
It's a solution, like, this one of the boxes we deal with that, we can't really put little convolutes on the firewall in the box, previous box, and a shitload of jails.
Well, you can do this on your network entry point, provided you're running PF, at least for this method.
Right.
I'm sure Cisco can also allow you to, you know,
like
there's more.
Like, HGuard is in the ports, but the release version has the stage ports, core dumps. Put the beta version, if you grab the source and install it, it's fine, but you can maintain whitelist and all day, and you can block it for X number of seconds and so on. What are you talking about?
George's that one.
I'm talking about another tool to deal with brute force attack.
Can you explain what SSH guard does?
It's an application called SSH guard that basically execs out of your syslog and will block, you know, the IP for X number of seconds. So,
yeah. Also, there's also like something called SSHD filter. Yeah, this is the article where I kind of started to read it. This is 2006. That's also on this little text file.
Cool.
So,
how many people think this is really important?
Question though, I'm not really a BSD guy. I have access to one BSD box to work and sort of a macro laptop. But what's the difference between BF IP filter and IFW or IFW?
Way outside.
Well, licensing, which is why IPF got removed
from. From my understanding, they're all BSD firewall things.
They're firewall things.
Very
well. IPF will run on Swires without a problem. IPF itself will run on Swires. There's a port for
IPF.
Swires. Yeah.
Is this IPF?
No, this is PF, which was IPF had its license changed. This was several years ago, and it got thrown out from OpenBSD base, right? So to retaliate, OpenBSD wrote PF, which, if anything, has more understandable syntax, and at this point, really. Provides you with a good level of control over your firewall and functionality. Like, you can do things like, I mean, this whole fact that you can actually go and say that if I get a SYN packet on this port more than like 8 times in 60 seconds, then do something with it. I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty cool. I don't think IPF ever does that.
Can I actually throw in like a one-liner so you can add this one? This guy, that gets way outside.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a long.
A one-liner would be that PF, in a nutshell, ends up being one of the first really 21st century looking packet filters that just become very popular because it's more than just a big bank of switches, right? It's actually a fairly sophisticated application that's easy to use.
Like IP tables without the weird looking syntax.
That's pretty much it. Rule sets and all that. But afterward, I mean, after the game kind of breaks up, there's tons of people in the room who love,
official working group.
We have a lot of fans. Anyways, back to this.
Anything else?
No, I don't know.
Cool.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, while we're on the topic, what does IP tables do better than, I know it's the BSD.
I have no idea. But after the meeting. We had a box that had like the connection tracking table on a NAT IP tables box would like crap itself at 30,000 entries. I'm sure it's tunable. There's probably sysctl things you can tune it with.
IP tables.
Yeah, with Linux.
Is Web 2.0 firm?
Linux kernel. It's on Web 2.0 firm.
I'm asking the opposite question. Has anyone discovered anything to do with IP tables that you're like, holy shit, I can't do that. Or I can't do it as easy.
I guess you got to make sure that it's not cops that it's good. I don't know. Can I ask you a favor before you get up?
Yeah.
Can I use your machine to open a text editor?
Yeah, what I got on something. You want a router, Michelle?
Not a terminal, because then just something I can make the text big and small.
Yeah, Firefox, dude. It's like plus 100.
No, but I'm not going to read. I'm going to type. Do you have one? I don't even know what it is.
No.
What do you mean? Like those types?
Yeah. But you can't really make it.
Yeah, clean your roof.
Do you want to vote on it?
Can you post your roof?
Doesn't matter. You can say this roof.
I'll give it to you. You can have it.
So this is back to you as roof.
All right. So everybody, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Max, for playing. Oh, there you go. Here's some passwords for you guys for database.
Thanks, Max. I should be able to type in there.
Yeah. Okay. Windows, all right. It's complicated.
But anyway, can I make it larger and smaller somehow?
Microsoft Word.
Is it really?
It's
got
to
be a way to zoom
it. Yeah, that'd be fine. Actually, Word would be fine.
You can do it in Firefox, right?
Just, like, just zooming, typing and zooming would be fine. Okay, so SSH keys. All right, moving on. This is just a primer. This is a 101 on SSH keys. And be warned that anybody who speaks up and they're like, oh, but I did this one cool thing, I'm going to walk you up.
Don't put it in that.
So please, speak up. That's your tips. Okay, so who in the room knows what SSH keys are? Yay! Thanks, Max. That's awesome.
Is that your password?
Who knows what SSH keys are?
One person
in the room knows what SSH keys are. How many people know how to spell cryptography? Okay.
People know how to pronounce cryptography.
Okay. SSH keys. Here's a pretty basic explanation. If anybody wants to correct me, feel free. SSH keys use public key encryption, right? And the simplest explanation of this is that you have two halves to a piece of data. You have a public key.
We got one grill.
We have her. Somebody explain this to ignore a lot.
Ron is probably. No, I'm not in the middle. I already have a bird.
I don't think it's in the room. Okay, so.
It's you guys here tonight. Sorry. I didn't
know. Okay. So, the situation with. So SSH keys. SSH keys, you have a public key and a private key, right? And these keys have a mathematical relationship to each other. Kind of like one of those stinky locket necklaces that you know, teenagers give each other when they're crushed out. And they only fit together, okay? So with that stated, this is kind of like a very high-level explanation. I don't know. We try to do some fun, and so I'll keep going with the easy stuff. Boring. Start cooling. The public key. You put your public key out on remote servers, and this public key can't do a whole lot of good for you. It doesn't unlock anything. It's the thing it's kind of analogous to the lock on your front door. It's the actual mechanism, lock mechanism, or it acts as a part of the lock mechanism. So when you go to, instead of using in SSH, instead of using a password to let you into the server, SSH ends up starting a really sophisticated little back and forth dance where the initiating client, you trying to log in from some remote place, says to the remote server, hey, I'm this user and going to want to do this key exchange. The other server uses your public key to encrypt a message that only your private key is going to be able to decrypt. They have this little relationship. The private key comes back with an answer. It's like a channel response back and forth. Private key comes back with an answer that goes to the other side, and only that private key would be able to get you in with what the public key has on the remote server. Okay? Does everybody kind of basically understand? I mean, if everything works out, ta-da, you have login on the remote server. Does that make sense to everybody? Does anybody have any questions about the basic kind of concepts? The crypto and all of the rest of the stuff in there, this is a 101. We're just going to let all that stuff go for the moment.
I think it's important to mention the passphrase is local to the private key.
Well, yeah, I'm actually going to hit that. Yes.
So in input, yes.
You may also mention session keys and host.
Ooh, you just got yourself. You just got yourself nominated to come up and say something about that today. Okay. Let me see here. So here's the deal. Let me go to my notes here. Okay, so when using keys, there's a few tips. I'm going to repost a URL from an email to the talk list where I actually explained a lot of this a long time ago. But nobody reads, you know, like coming here and drinking instead. Let me see, I wrote it, I need to read it. The big points are when you're using SSH keys, let me start typing here for a second. Go MS Word for caps. Okay, so the man page is not with a capital M, okay? If you read the man page for SSH keygen, there's all kinds of incredible detail and pretty clear-cut instructions for how to use any feature of keys. Right? People have been using this stuff for a long time. It's really sophisticated. It's a really amazing tool. Therefore, it has a lot of various options. And I haven't met or worked with anybody who knows every single aspect of it. You know, everything about using SSH keys, hence this meeting tonight, so to speak. So, with that stated, that's the definitive place. I'm not going to go through a step-by-step. I'm actually going to post a really bastardized version of the man page to the talk list later on tonight after the meeting, so that when we go home and actually do what I'm talking about right now, you can do it step-by-step. It's really easy. But here's some big points with all this stuff. When using SSH keys, start off making really, really big keys. CPUs are really cheap. Does anybody have in the room, besides their phone perhaps, a CPU on their person that's smaller than 800 megahertz? Nobody make fun of you. I swear to God. Like, that's actually pretty hardcore. All right! One person. All right. So it's going to take maybe like 5 more seconds when you're logging in than it should have for these big 4096-bit keys to actually go through the exchange when you're authenticating yourself to a remote system. That's still not a lot of time. Using huge keys does not really matter these days. All right, the crypto operations and even scaling those crypto operations is all pretty cheap. Right? And would you actually agree with me? Because you're in an environment where you're managing lots and lots of SSH logins that are all happening simultaneously, and scaling that's cheap. Is that fair enough to say?
Yeah.
Got it. CPU's cheap. Yeah.
Using SDP, that's not really
a good option. Well, actually, you know what? Your comments understood, but not necessarily true, because the only part during the SSH exchange, SSH isn't doing the actual crypto for the communications. It's only about doing the crypto for the authentication for the session. So if you're going to SCP a large file, the only part where these big, massive crypto keys are going to be used is right at the beginning when you're knocking on the door and it's letting you in. Once the file starts transferring, you're using whatever crypto you've already got, you know, in the default config or whatever you've configured.
It's quite matching and
yeah.
Swap.
No, but that's a very good point. So what?
The default encryption algorithm that you use during the transfer can be swapped out on the command line.
Yes.
After doing some testing with our file, I got this performance that using GoFish for the transfer. He said significant
load. That is two different caps for key. The compression flag, but that stuff's in the man page. That's what he was just talking about, actually. Okay, so moving down. Here's the deal. You want to lock your keys, though, with passphrase, because you've got these two pieces of data, which, when you actually look at the physical key, it's just a bunch of plain text, right? It's a bunch of garbage. So you got to protect this. If your private key is the thing that lets you, this file, it's a bunch of plain text, is the thing that lets you into all the remote servers you're working on. This file has to be seriously protected, right? Because anybody who gets this file is just like losing the keys to your house, can just walk right in. So, with that stated, there's a number of different strategies for how to deal with this. The big one that's really important is to lock your local key. Give your local key a password. Now, think to yourself, like, why am I doing this in the first place? If I've got to type a password to unlock my key, which is replacing my use of a password remotely, right? The big threat here are remote brute force attempts, which Max was just talking about, just dropping and eliminating. Where did Max go? Totally disappeared. Okay. The, tough crowd, I've forgotten. Is this making sense to everybody? Okay, so why am I doing this? Why would I want a password locally when I just got rid of the password remotely? Well, the passphrase that you're entering when you lock your SSH key is nothing that ever leaves the local system that you're touching. So whatever machine you're using your private key from, wherever you enter that passphrase, that should be a machine that you trust, right? A machine that you have locked down within reason or needing some kind of other business guidelines or personal guidelines or whatever is reasonable, right? This is not a, you don't want to go dropping your keys in some internet cafe, whether it be a keylogger or something else, and somebody watching everything or copying all this data. Plug in that USB key, you know, sit there, unlock your SSH key, because you don't trust that machine, right? Or another, somebody in the office, like an external consultant who just came in to do something, you know, you slap your private keys on and from their machine, just start logging into company resources. You get yourself into all kinds of trouble that way. So the idea is that you still need to protect where you use your keys from, right? So dropping your private keys on public server, remote servers, those need to be servers that are seriously trusted public resources, remote resources. Okay, so everybody with me still on this so far? Okay. The other deal, though, with keys and a place that you see them deployed, they see them used a lot, and I see them all the time used in really, really, really grotesque, dangerous ways, is to, and you can do it in really non-dangerous ways, is to have SSH keys so that automated things, cron jobs, daemons, programs, events that are happening on systems can trigger remote events on other Unix systems without needing a login. So you just end up wrapping Unix commands in SSH and executing them remotely. This is a pretty cool strategy, unless you take several machines and all of them have brute things with a set of unencrypted keys, tossing all kinds of root login commands between machines. This is, of course, an incredibly dangerous and silly situation, right? So you just want to be logical about how you deploy keys that don't have passwords. So that kind of, you think that that's a good, did I miss any big key points? Why passwords?
Sure. Yeah, if you want to mention the authorized keys options, you can throw in them.
Can you actually mention the authorized keys options? Can you explain what the authorized keys options are?
So within the authorized keys on each server, you can dictate inside the key on the public side which commands or which options are allowed to be executed remotely. For example, you can disable forwarding. If they use this key, you can disable forwarding. Any sort of exporting or remote forwarding or local forwarding, whatever. You can also dictate which commands can be run using this specific key. So you can say, if you have a root key and you have this root key that's only allowed to do backup stuff, you can say, this key can only run these specific executables, and that's it. It can't do forwarding, it can't do anything else, and you can limit it that way within the public key.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something you can sort of lock down further, or you could use other commands like sudo.
Does that take more than, can you put in more than one command?
Yes. And you can use more than one key. So you can use one key for, your authorized key, you can keys file can have multiple keys in it. So you can have one key that's for backups, one key that's for, whatever reason.
Could that be used to only allow somebody to do SCP file transfers and not actually give them a shell?
RSync only shell.
No, I don't think so. SCP, you're talking about doing it, you're talking about replacing the shell at that point. There's that thing called SCP only, which is a shell replacement on the remote side. And that
was RSync only, whatever, did you compile it?
We have support, or it depends on which OS it is.
I think an important thing to say that RSync only, I think you can still, in your SSE call, you can still tell it to run other commands. Like if you run ls, if your shell is RSync, you can still run ls if you call that after SSE.
Cool.
That's why you want to have people only access their home directory with RSync as a shell.
Got it. That's actually an okay segue into then using tools like SSH agent. So say you have,
one quick question.
Yes.
Is there no option to allow expiry of SSH keys, like BTP keys, or BTP keys? You don't allow it for whatever you
want. Boy, that's a good question. You know, that's something that I don't know. Can somebody answer that or look at
it? You're better off doing it at the account.
Right. That's the direction I was just going to go with this. Another thing that I was going to say here, just in terms of best practices with SSH keys, is that even with large keys, changing them often is really important. Just like, you know, any other environment where you have to change passwords, change any kind of login credentials. Because over time, you know, your keys could get taken by somebody. And theoretically, there's all the CPU power. Theoretically, even big keys could be cracked if you had enough time and CPU with the problem. So you want to change your keys on a regular basis. I would think that there are not. I have never come across or never thought of ways to expire keys in that same way, because you run into a threat where something is fundamental to, hey, like, suddenly we're all locked out of our production servers because we made our keys expire, and we don't have a way back into them to update all of our keys. That would be a really terrible problem.
Right, it's about authentication method, not authorization method. The host does the authorization.
Right.
There's no way to expire a key. The only solution to do that would be to put a PKI and rewrite that into a stage, which there's a patch out there.
What's the patch to integrate?
Well, actually, it was written by Dan and Hardinger, who wrote PF. It was done about 2 years ago.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years ago. It was posted on tech at openbsd.org with the Melanesi substitute. It's a mark. You can find it. but it was rejected for a couple of reasons. For the exact reason that it's probably going to touch upon if you want to talk about it, is that there was no way to globally revoke keys.
Right.
Or revoke them, not only. So it kind of gets down to the GPG, PGP model.
Right. So that actually, stumbling, that's really cool that you brought up, and that stumbles us into a kind of a bigger, it was like my last point, but it's a kind of a bigger, scarier thought in that we all use, everybody in this room, even though nobody raised their hand, nobody in the room uses SSH, we all use it all day long, we all rely really tremendously heavily on SSH. And you start looking at the outside world, when you start looking at the rest of the world, you realize that a gigantic chunk of the entire world relies on SSH. Now, what was it? When exactly? Does anybody remember the date? Here's a good one. It might get you points towards that little bonus gift thing. Does anybody remember the date that the SSH1 had its zero-day attack? Does anybody remember the date? Start throwing out roughly a couple years ago.
Did you, did anybody see the matrix?
Prior to SSH 2 coming out, 2001?
SSH 2 had been, the protocol had been out before the 0 day on SSH 1 came. But, anyone remember? Go on.
Do they have other significance?
Okay, so I'm gonna call that one like way lower points whenever somebody gets it. Somebody look it up and say it. Because nobody got it. The basically what I'm getting at though is that we all do all of this stuff to rely on one piece of software that is an incredibly well-written piece of software, probably one of the most mature examples of a secure piece of software that anybody can point the finger at in the world and say, this is terrific. It's got all kinds of niceties that a lot of us really actually don't notice because they just work. Like the way that SSH deals with packet loss, deals with actual network socket disconnections, and all of this really, really terrific stuff that make our day-to-day computing lives really, really cool. So, with all that stated, we all use this one thing that is not necessarily perfect, that could, we could hit a day in the future where a public key infrastructure would use for, we could all use public key infrastructure to log into various systems. That would be an incredibly fundamental change to the way we do world login sessions. We could also just hit another day where there's a massive exploit in the design of not just OpenSSH or any vendor's implementation of SSH, but in the fundamental design of the protocol, which is what happened with this SSH version 1 zero day, right? So this kind of whips me around to a reason, answering that reason for why we use, or why I use keys and why I think they're important. And why entering a password locally is more important than entering it remotely. When that SSH version 1 exploit happened, I was working at the time for a very small web hosting company that ran a lot of GLM systems. That was a really bad day for us because this meant that somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 systems needed to be patched immediately. And not all of these, systems were directly in our control. They belonged to the people who, we gave them to. Because we were using SSH keys on all of our key servers, we were spared from feeling the impact of anything that day. Not because SSH keys solved the problem, but in that particular instance, the way that the attack worked, people dealing with not getting a password login made and having to deal with the actual mechanisms of writing exploits that dealt with the big, we were using these 4,096 bit keys back then, big ones back then, it felt like. Because of that, we weren't low-lying fruit. They could go move on to lots and lots of other systems. People all over the world were wailing and gnashing their teeth and machines were getting hosed all over the place. And we had enough time to jump in, patch all of our systems, and move on with our lives. So we were lucky, is basically what I'm saying. That's, I'm not saying that SSH keys would save us in the next situation in the same way. But that was a perfect example of exactly why SSH keys can be really important. If anybody else also has any cool stories about that kind of stuff, feel free. I'll drag you up. With that stated, let me see if we missed anything else. Oh yeah, RSA versus DSA example. Is everybody itching to go grab drinks, or should wrap this up sooner or later? Does anybody have any input or questions about RSA versus DSA keys? I'm jumping from the 101 to like a little advanced.
I'm dying in your mind to say RSA versus DSA.
Are you kidding?
I'm dying in your mind.
Okay.
No, I'm dead serious.
Because everybody has their spiel about it, and to be honest, I'm saying it's completely
mine less. Is like, well, I'm curious. My statement is to be very, I'm not a cryptographer, I'm not a crypto analyst. I run Unix systems, all right? So with all that stated, for me, it's all about choosing my poison, because you've got RSA is old, right? It comes from MIT in the late 70s. Am I correct? DSA comes from the NSA, the American NSA, in the 90s. So it's basically everybody's been anticipating replacements for RSA for quite some time, but the replacement came from an organization that, you know, not a lot of people who work in security in the world who aren't the NSA like very much. Not today. So there's a lot of reasons why various organizations, and they're not like big conspiracy theories about RSA's got, you know, got backdoor the world and all that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of good reason to, if you, how can I put it, to choose the reasons behind why you would want to trust any technology over another technology. So that's my two cents on RSA versus DSA. Does anybody have anything about, like, performance? Yeah.
Well, I just remember back in the day, RSA used to be illegal. I mean, you had to license it. It was a commercial product, it was a company.
Sure.
You couldn't use the keys without paying for them, you know? So it was like, DSA was a thing. And also, I think there was a rule, like, RSA I always thought was better because, like, you had to get a special arrangements to use it outside of the USA because it was, like, military technology.
Export control stuff. Right.
Like weak enough that you didn't have to deal with it. There was something that you. Maybe PSA was partly developed outside of the
or because it was developed by and large by the NSA that they're in positions in U.S. government where they could, not because they're crazy. Hey, anybody wants to take this according to other theories, go for it. Not my position here to do so. But, you know, if you're the NSA and you're developing this replacement for RSA and there's all these encryption export problems, and you're a government agency, and you're a government agency that every other government agency looks at and goes, they're the smart guys. So if the smart guys say, it's okay, just export this stuff, everybody's going to go, oh, okay. And you just bypass it.
Yeah, because I don't think the export rules in themselves actually, you know, was based on what was really valuable, what wasn't really valuable, right? I mean, it was kind of a little BS. It was really theatrical, first of all. And then when Clinton dropped it, whatever, in 97, 98, mm-hmm. It wasn't like, oh, wow, it's great. All it meant was it was easier for American businesses to export.
Yeah, it was not great, though. It's going to take a lot less to crack whatever physicists could eat.
Right, but it's also under the delusion that somehow, like, the center of all research and development is in the U.S.
I thought it was nice, but
keys for like the first 10 years. I was using DSA keys for the first X number of years, and then all of a sudden I was allowed to use RSA keys. So I said, "Screw it! I'm using RSA keys because that's what I'm allowed to." And that was just—I'd never done the research.
No, but it's just the whole export encryption thing. I thought was a little.
It's his.
It was overdone.
I'm sure.
Yeah, it was kind of a joke, you know. It was like,
is that over?
Yeah, it was. I think.
Yeah, basically, yeah. That's
very likely there.
A lot of us. Yeah.
You know, if you're Venezuela or something. But it's likely there still, but it's much more loose than that. Very, very loose.
That's kind of my own thing. I think that
Diffie Hellman came out with the crude version of public key cryptography, right? So then in the 80s, basically Thatcher was attacking, slashing public spending and said, it's all in the private sector, nothing good's ever come out of public money. These guys came out and they're, you know, GCHQ or whatever, they came, it was the late 60s, early 70s, whatever it was, they came and said, by the way, we actually developed it, you know, earlier with public money, kind of the propaganda point in Thatcher. And they mentioned Diffie Hellman in the 70s and in the early 80s at some point, and they actually went back and sat in the bar with them for a few hours. And they were like, yeah, these guys did do it. We know they did it. After talking to them, so it's a good story.
It's cool.
Well, you had mentioned SSH agent. Are you going to talk more about it?
Oh, SSH agent. I'll speak really briefly on it.
but I don't want to get into all the details.
Explain what it is. It's
useful. SSH agent is really cool. It allows you to use multiple SSH keys and lock them all. Multiple SSH keys that themselves have passwords to. It allows you to put them all into SSH agent and use one passphrase to unlock SSH agent, unlocking all of your keys. So if your typical work morning ends up logging into, end up working in or logging into a bunch of disparate systems that all have different SSH keys for different reasons, you're going to be jumping through. Go for it.
Okay, basically you load your SSH key into memory, and when you do that, at the time you load it into memory, you unlock the key. And from then on, your SSH client can authenticate against this key that's already been pre-authenticated, so you're not prompted for a password each time you hit a new system. This is especially useful when you're trying to manage hundreds of servers and you're scripting, and you don't want to be prompted for a password for each server you hit.
Yeah, that was a more succinct answer than I could give. I appreciate it. Yeah. Yes.
So is there the time to bring up PAM SSH? Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, ask it. I may just deflect it to somebody else.
No, I'm just saying. PAM SSH is a PAM authorization module that allows the starting of the SSH agent during logging.
Got it.
So it uses the password that you're supplying on the key, but it still allows you to load keys instantly without being prompted for password. I got it, from your local machine. Yeah, got it, okay, cool.
Another good one.
Log in and SSH agent call by
PAM module during an authentication of logging to the local system. It actually loads.
Very cool.
Wait, PAM is pluggable authentication module.
Yes.
You can use anything. You can use Kerberos, LDAP, NIST.
Well, this is a module that actually,
it's a module for SSH agent, or it's a module for what?
SSH agent during before X session, everything started. It just starts up SSH agent, so every process that starts is a sequential to started after that inherits the properties of.
It actually sounds like it's just launching SSH agent in your init script as you're launching X or whatever.
No, it's actually supplying the key, the password for the keys as well.
You're loading your system password, and now it's same as your
password. Well, if you have that. It works if you have the same password on your key and your system.
And what if you don't?
Well,
then you can't
use that. You're left on your own. But you still got SSH agent running.
It just asks you the question.
It's called PAM-SSH?
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. Excellent. All right.
It's not the best way of doing security things, but it's still convenient.
Very cool.
Oh.
So with
convenience is way more important. That's why OpenBSD enables root logging by default in SSH.
This is the moment then where I could ask for a last show of hands. I'll answer your question. Last show of hands. Was all of this, has this now inspired everybody to not even have enabled password authentication for shells on their systems?
No.
Is this all inspiring? What do you guys think? What do you think? Is this one?
Let me answer this. The difference between SSHD and the PAM support in FreeBSD versus Net and Open.
But we're talking about openness.
I think he's mostly talking
about open SSH. Yeah, I'm actually with NoPod 100% on that one.
We'll mention it in a second.
Pam, we want to do sudo.
They
enable Pam.
The sudo password.
In order to make can you repeat that to the group?
Yeah.
Can you repeat that loud? Hold on, everybody's fragmented.
Opening that. I think what you're talking about is passwords for, wait.
So you can't connect via SSH and enter a password to get into the box, so you have to use your key.
Right, but you have to use your password to your key.
No.
Bring up an SSH key config.
I can't do SSH this box and actually get a password box.
Hold on, you guys stop. Max, hold on. You guys, the answer that you're looking for is in your SSH key configuration on your remote server. There's one line that lets you, you know, not disallow password authentication altogether. That's it.
No, but once you set up with the keys, it's not going to matter anyway. You'll just go straight through.
If you don't disallow password logins, your password logins and the keys will both
still. The reason where passwords still do make a difference is what if you have sudo access, right? Sudo is going to ask you for the user password. It's like asking for the key password.
He's talking about password like a prompt.
He's talking about, so you actually SSH, you need to prompt for the password, and then look up your password instead of shadow or whatever, but you can then, instead of saying, rather than looking up an etcetera password, you can look at a key only. I don't have a key on the system, don't prompt me for a password. And what you'd actually get access to the system would be sudo, it'll sudo, then.
Once you're on your Unix, that's not the scope of my conversation. Like 101. Once you got a shell, I don't care.
You don't allow passwords during the login. Now you can actually be on the system.
Or it's a common
Actually, you know what you just asked, SK, is a really cool, good question. Another cool use of SSH keys. You don't need to be passing around. How many people have set stupid passwords for people's first time logging into a system that they're giving a shell to? How many people there have ever done that?
And it got old later too.
Yeah. And how many people have had users who left F00BAR in as a password for, you know, a year? All right.
Is it door?
So is it door? Yeah. So with all that stated, public keys are really cool because then somebody who's administering a system and has root on a given system adds the user, hey, you know, email somebody, hey, so and so, I just gave you a shell on the system. And the user who can't log in yet, doesn't have a password, could say, oh, great, here's my public key, and send it as text in email. And an administrator can drop that public key into the proper place in their own directory. And then the user on the other end suddenly can just log in, and that's all there is to it. So what you just did was you created a situation where the user said, does everybody understand the exchange that just happened here between human beings? A user who doesn't have an access to a system sent their public key to the administrator. That public key doesn't unlock anything by itself. All right. That public key, once placed in the right place in their home directory, will allow them to log into the server. Right? So something that if they have their private key. Right? So you just made a situation where somebody eavesdropping on the emails, somebody reading the emails, whatever, none of that matters at all, realistically, in terms of getting the person in, and no bad password was given, or stupid password that somebody may or may not change, or you have to go audit and make sure that they did change. None of that just happened. Does that make sense to everyone? Everybody's like, here. Great. Say what? Yeah, and you can post your keys on the internet. You can post your public keys on the internet.
Should we start a PKI for SSH public keys for a nice club?
about the public key. Is there a way to audit those to see if they're requiring passwords or not?
That's Kate just asked that, and there is not?
There's none.
Okay.
But cool. You think I can take my private key and strip the passwords away or put new passwords on it or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no. Sorry. For some people talking about getting Sarbanes-Oxley, that actually sucks because they have to verify that.
So the question is, though, if you have access to someone else's private key for whatever reason, can you tell that there's a password associated with that?
Can you tell?
Yeah. But I guess the question is, you can try. And if you're not running through a password on a box with
that, you can open up a cell command, you can try and read the key, and it'll, like, barf with you. Like, or try and convert the key or whatever. If you have any key operations on it, it's going to
be.
Can't do it on the public side. Yeah, can you go on your private side? Okay. Does anybody have any more questions? I've got the last little giveaway thing to do. No more questions?
Okay. I have a question, but I have a little topic for discussion. Something. I sent this to the list like about half an hour before the meeting, so you guys probably haven't read it. But it's from Linux. It's from Gentoo Linux. It's called Keychain. And it's a little wrapper script that you can call when you log in. And what it does is it takes your private keys and it launches. Well, the first thing it does is it checks to see if you have an existing SSH agent running and ties into that SSH agent so you don't have to re-authenticate and launch SSH agent every time. Basically, it makes using SSH agent easy.
Like, because it forwards your SSH agent status between the machines.
Between logging sessions. So like I log in, and if I have SSH agent running, it uses the existing SSH agent. But if it doesn't, it launches it upon login, prompts me for all my keys that I have configured with this keychain thing, and away you go. Like, and so until the machine is next rebooted, you don't have to type in passwords again to re-authenticate SSH agent.
What's
the
difference between that and SSH agent?
Does SSH agent
You don't have to manage the session and the environmental variables and all that stuff. It manages it for you.
But you only launch SSH agents once when you log in, and that's it. You never have to touch it again.
If you log out again, that stuff is no longer in your environment. Like the PID and everything else. And if you start a new session on the same machine, like say I SSH into a box and I log this at one SSH agent, I'm supposed to take the output of it and like do an SSH add, or I don't remember. It's been a while since I manually done it, a few years actually. But if I start a new SSH session into that same box, the same account, it's not going to know about my SSH agent. So if I try and SSH from there to a box that has my public key, it's going to prompt me for my password. But what this does is it wraps all that. So every time I log in, it attaches to my existing SSH agent.
Have you tried forward agent? Because that's what forward agent does. It forwards your agent environment variables from one box to that.
This actually reattaches if you have a screen running on a remote machine, you close your session, open a new session, the screen that runs actually loses, when you close the connection first time, you lose the SSH agent connection. So this application actually reattaches.
And it stores, like,
I'll
send you to the list if you're on the list.
Okay. I can throw one last thing in actually about
it stores a PID of the SSH agent in like a dot file in your directory, like dot keychain or whatever. You know, so you can reattach to that SSH agent and know that that's what you're listening to.
Maybe the other thing too is that if you actually have multiple terminals, if I can remember this
what I did was in my my profile. So I actually then of that like do whatever it is like a SSH PIN or whatever account is variable. You actually val that file. So this way then you can reattach everything. So if you have multiple terminals like screen or just open up two SSH sessions into a machine, you're still sharing that same SSH agent without actually having to export it manually.
I've never had that problem. I run a SSH agent from XinitRC. So every shell that I launch after I launch X basically inherits all my merges. But I mean, there's got to be something else that
it brings. Well, what it is most people launch SSH agent manually. It's not part of the. It's not one SSH agent.
That's something
else. It's like an SSH agent. Each person may launch their own SSH agent. He may launch an SSH agent on the box. He may launch one. I may launch one. It's like if you're running from X and in, what user are you running
with? Yeah. Who using is your? Well, I guess my thing is that I only run agent as my desktop. I would never run a server, right? If anything, I would do it forward if I wanted to.
Well, I mean, if you have like a jump host or a box where you SSH from, like if you have a Windows workstation, you're good.
Right. Well, that's why I was saying there's a forward agent, so you can forward your the agent across.
Right.
I
sent it to the list if you guys are interested.
Can I throw one more thing out about third-party apps like this? Because using SSH over the years, I've seen apps like this come and go, but they've never met like a negative end. Because what you're talking about sounds like a pretty cool feature. Not something that I've encountered as a personal need, but or something ready to work. But that's a pretty intelligent thing. The number of users and then the amount of developer attention on OpenSSH is gigantic. The number of well-implemented, well-thought-out features that have had lots and lots of input from the community of users, which is everybody in this room, is also astoundingly huge. So I've seen lots and lots of things even before SSH Keychain got, you know, turned into a really cool tool. And boy, late 90s, I remember all kinds of widgety apps, some of them were like GUI funny apps and things like that that were really bizarre for managing your SSH keys. And by and large, all of those things over the years have disappeared. The features were integrated in some really thoughtful way into OpenSSH. So I find it really useful to actually read through and skim through the OpenSSH man page every once in a while, because always, every time I do, I will learn something new that will help my day out. Or I'll learn something new that I go, wow, that's cool, and I'll forget about it, and I'll remember a year later and use it. You know? So that's it. Okay, so this dude over here who's claimed that he's never used a BSD box except once at work. I don't think anybody's going to have any complaints if this guy gets this little micro USB key.
What's your name?
Brian.
All right.
Brian was probably.
This is our good
power supply.
Yeah, Brian was asked the most number of questions. And this thing's so teeny that you're going to have to.
It actually slides into a USB slot.
Yeah, of course. Oh, cool. So, thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you. Thanks for actually everybody who contributed.
I have one more quick thing.
Of course.